Today on the show, we have a whale of a time with a good mate of mine, Ruairi Duncan. We dive deep into Ruairi's past, reminiscing about childhood trips to the Natural History Museum in London, the rocky road to university or college, get sidetracked with the adorable ornithopod dinosaurs, and finally, whales. Pals in Paleo presents Fossil Whales and Ornithopod Dinosaurs with Ruairi Duncan. Let's go back. This is Pals in Paleo, a podcast fueled by caffeine, bringing you the facts on the form, function, and family groupings of weird and wonderful fossils. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and chronic tea drinker Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show by subscribing in your podcast app, or you can follow us on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, all one word, paleo spelled P-A-L-A-E-O. Pals in Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia, country, and connection to the land, sky, all waterways, and community. We pay our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today, particularly peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nations, on whose land this episode was recorded. Other parts of this episode were also recorded on Kaua Country in central western Queensland. Fossils of ornithopod dinosaurs from the Cretaceous coast of Victoria are known from the traditional lands of the Boonwurrung, and the fossil whales Jandocetus and Mammalodon are known from Jandjak. And we acknowledge the separate and distinct Eastern Ma and Wadwurrung peoples as the traditional owners of the Great Ocean Roads land. This episode was recorded with assistance and cooperation of staff in the paleontology department at Museums Victoria. I'm back after a wee break. Thank you so much for your patience. There's been a lot going on behind the scenes, which I can't talk about just yet, but I've been working on some really cool stuff for my PhD, and you'll definitely be hearing about it later this year. Can't wait to share it with you. But we've also been renovating our house, so that's been a massive pain in the butt. We haven't had a ceiling for weeks now, and literally everything's upside down at the moment, so just bear with me as we try and move forward and get some semblance of a home together. Aside from this impromptu life update, I've got a couple of announcements. They're actually corrections to last episode with the delightful Jack O'Connor on Zygomaturus. So in that episode, I stuffed up a couple times. I mentioned anapsid and synapsid skulls being based on the number of openings in the skull. Just totally forget all of that garbage because Steve Poropat, my PhD supervisor, our guest on our episode on Savannosaurus, messaged me after and informed me, totally outdated. It's not really supported by any recent studies being done. So yeah, my bad. He also said Eurizygoma is Pliocene. It's from the Pliocene, whereas Zygomaturus is Pleistocene. So even though they're both massive extinct marsupials with big cheeks, big zygomatic arches, they didn't overlap in time. Completely different time periods. And the last thing I wanted to mention is on the ancient but very much alive Tuatara. Quick reminder, they are much loved and native to New Zealand or Aotearoa. They look a lot like lizards, but they're definitely not lizards. Tuatara are actually lepidosaurs, but not squamates. So they share a more recent common ancestor with snakes and lizards than they do with any other extant group, any living group. So that kind of makes sense based on how they look. But again, that split happened many, many, many millions of years ago. So sorry if you listened to that stuff and was rightfully shouting at me, but this is a podcast and I cannot hear you when you do that. Unless you at me, of course. In which case, I'm at Pals in Paleo on Instagram. That's the best way to get my attention. But that's just how the game is. That's how it goes. Science is self-correcting. So the best way to stay up to date is to listen to other podcasts, other sources, and recent episodes for fresh facts. That's it for announcements. And I feel like I should give you fair warning about this episode. Don't worry, I removed the swears that we slipped in before. But the thing I wanted to say was this is a really long chat. Probably work that out when you hit download on today's episode. But Ruairi and I are friends and collaborators. So of course, this is a meandering discussion. And he was actually gracious enough to talk openly about his grades during high school and undergrad. When I look at him today and everything that he's done, I'm reminded that nothing is make or break. There are always more opportunities to do the thing you're passionate about. And I'm so much better for it and for knowing him and for having him in my life. And I hope you get a glimmer of that too. Before we get into that interview, though, it is absolutely necessary that I tell you a random fossil fact. This is the audio equivalent of a warm-up routine before we get to the real workout. Today's random fossil fact is that there are fossil whales in Legend of Zelda. Kind of. So Legend of Zelda, if you haven't heard of it, it's a hero's journey video game where you play as Link, the legendary hero of time, on a quest to save the kingdom of Hyrule from Ganon, bringing chaos across the land. There's swords, archery, horse riding, and monsters you have to battle and defeat. And in the last two games, both on the Nintendo Switch, Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, there are these massive bones of things called leviathans. They look a lot like whales, and one of the things I love most about this is that there's literally a massive fossil whale species called Leviathan, which we talk about right at the end of this episode. And if you listen to our episode on Pelagornis with Ben, A Fool's Experiment, you would have heard us talk about it too. In the real world, Leviathan is a massive macro-raptorial sperm whale, so a whale that ate other whales back in the day. But in the Zelda universe, the Leviathans, they don't have massive teeth the size of sweet potatoes, for better or worse. There's three different Leviathan skeletons in Zelda, and they're not all the same either. And look, it's probably a callback to other creatures in the universe. And was this just a convoluted plot to talk about Zelda? Well, yeah, but Ruri and I are both massive fans, so I thought it was worth mentioning. In the game, there's also a fantastic side quest featuring NPCs, so non-playable characters, arguing about why these massive creatures went extinct. Each present three different theories, and it's so choice. Such an accurate portrayal of scientific discussion. I felt both seen and called out by Zelda, which is weird because honestly, that game has nothing to do with paleontology. As I said before, there's lots of whale talk towards the end of this episode, but for now, let's get into it and hear how a young Scottish lad made his way into the world of paleontology. Here he is, Ruri Duncan. Today on the show, we are chatting with a really good mate of mine, Ruri Duncan, a paleontologist and now award-winning paleo artist.
Yes, I forgot about that. Yes, I'm award-winning, technically. Hello, everyone.
Do you remember the first time we met? Can I tell the story then?
Please.
Yeah. You had come to Winton to help
was
relocate.
Was that the first time we met?
Yeah, I think so. Because I remember Steve and Tim were coming up.
Yes.
And then you were also in the car too. Because I think at the time you were at Federation Uni.
I think I was between units at the time. Because I did my undergrad at Federation. In my last semester at Federation, I got all of the paleo stuff I've been trying to do for my whole degree backloaded and met all the paleo folks and started volunteering at the museum. And yeah, that was the first proper dig I got to go on, was going all the way up to Winton to try and get those trackways out of Snake Creek.
Yeah, you'd come along because you'd done like a third year research project.
I had, and it had been on footprints as well, personally, although nowhere near as spectacular as the one that you guys had up in Winton. I did ones on some tracks that are in Skeens Creek, which is in the Otways. They were fine. There's no associated pathways, which is not as fun as giant sauropods wandering through a mudflat.
So what's the difference between a track and a trackway?
So the tracks that I described from my third year research project, they were individual tracks, all kind of pointing in the same direction, but there were no associated where you'd see one footprint go to the next footprint, go to the next footprint, go to the next footprint.
And that's a trackway.
I think
so. One after the other.
But that from that, you can work out things like, you know, the gait and the speed and the weight, all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's like paleontology meets forensics, essentially.
Yeah, you're doing, you're reconstructing the behavior of an animal as well, which is a really cool thing.
Yeah.
Which lived 150 million years ago. It's crazy.
There are dig tracks, there are dinosaurs doing possibly like displays, and they're scratching and scooping. There's resting impressions, which I love to think of as butt prints. There's all sorts of things that
there
you can
find. There
are
actually butt prints as well.
Yeah. And you can find the texture sometimes if you're lucky to, I think.
Spectacular.
Love a good texture of a butt. Why did I make it weird? So I've known you for a little while now.
5 years. Wow. 5 years. And that's time. you have gone from strength to strength and done all this amazing Pterosaur work and this amazing podcast. So here you go.
This is not about me. This is your episode though. And because we're mates, like I kind of know a little bit about what you were like as a kid, especially after staying with your folks at PDU3, which is where I recorded the episode with Jake, with the chaotic table smashing.
The table smashing incident, yes. Yeah. That moment was immediately preceded by my dad and my brother picking that table up and my brother asking him, is that going to fall? He said, No. Sure enough. Beautiful Icarus moment.
Yeah. Glass tables or glass screen doors, if you have them diagonally, so all the weight is on one corner, I've heard they explode. And I think that's what happened.
Yes. All evidence points to this being the case.
Yeah.
You got to stay in my mother's shrine to me, which is the spare bedroom. It's full of my art. That does sound weirder than it is. It's all of my artwork I did when I was in high school, like these big canvases. So obviously they're still at my parents' house. So whenever anyone comes by to stay, you've got to stay with my big dinosaurs roaring at fighter jets, I think is one of them. Yeah, yeah. There's another one which is like some angry penguins and giraffes. How was that?
It was funny because it was like, you have to stay in the Ruri Shrine. And I was like, oh boy. And then got let in, like a beautiful space and like obviously great because I didn't have to pay for accommodation during the conference. But I was like, there's no pictures here.
No.
And I was like, oh no, I've been doing shrines wrong my whole life. Anyway.
What shrines do you have?
That's not important.
Okay.
When you were a kid, though, you were obsessed with dinosaurs, hey?
100%. Well, secondarily. My first obsession was trains.
You ruined the punchline. I had a whole lead in. I was going to say, did you choose anything else before trains?
Oh, that's you should do fine. That again. No, you should do that again. That's fine. Anyway, I had little model train sets and I went to train bridges and I watched them go under and I made the drivers honk their horns. It was great.
The moment you told me this last week, I was like, oh, I instantly understand you a lot better now.
I'm a train kid. I'm obviously a train kid. Come on. Anyway, it was dinosaurs for most of my childhood. We had like an annual trip. Every time my birthday came around, we would go.
Now, at the time you were living in Scotland, in case no one has figured it out yet, Rory is Scottish and that's how you pronounce his name.
That is how you pronounce my name. And it does spell that way. And I don't know why.
Doing kindergarten on level 11 at the gate.
Yes, yes. Until I was about four, I used to get very upset that people would never spell my name right. And I think about 4 or 5 years old, I realized that that was never going to happen.
A lost cause. Oh my gosh. I mean, like, I can kind of understand that though, because it's just like a basic way you give respect to someone, you know, saying their name correctly, using the pronouns that they prefer.
Yes, but
stuff.
If it doesn't follow the language rules of English, it follows the language rules of Gaelic, which are not the same rules. So it's understandable that people look at it and go, Mr. Duncan? but yeah, no, I grew up in Scotland until I was 5, and I lived in Gloucestershire in the West Country of England till I was 10. Then I went back to Scotland till I was 13 before moving to Australia for the first time.
It's been a lot of back and forth.
Yes.
Because of your dad's job.
Yes. Yeah. My dad is very good at pricing ships, apparently. Of all things.
Sounds so untechnical. Like he's just got a prize gun and he's just like, done.
Pretty much. I mean, fundamentally, what we're doing is looking at rocks and describing phylogenetic characters and taxonomic meaning to them. He's pricing ships.
We love you, Richard.
We respect you. I'm sorry I mocked your accent. But yes, that's apparently a quite in-demand thing. So we moved from Scotland to England, from England to Scotland, from Scotland to Victoria. Then we moved from Victoria to WA, and from WA to Canada. And it was after we moved to Canada that I moved back to Victoria by myself. So circuitous route here, you might say.
Yeah. And then sort of spending your, I guess, younger years in Scotland and England as well. There are a bunch of great history museums over there.
100%. Though, if you were to ask Ked Rory, only one exists, and that was the Natural History Museum in London, which every single year for my birthday, from about the age of 5 to 8 or 9, I think, every single year we would go to the Natural History Museum, take all the pictures, draw some pictures of the dinosaurs, get the little T-Rex on a plastic handle that you could pull the little handle as jaws would close. They had weird little Deinonychus with the black stripy tail, and it had wire in it so you could pose it. It was the best toy I ever had. It's great.
Okay, I need to find a photo of...
Oh, you definitely... No, yeah. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Because the NHM is famous for these famous. It's notable for these animatronic...
Among other things.
Among other things. But yes, it has these animatronic Deinonychus, which have been there since, I think, like the late 90s.
Have they aged well or no?
No.
Oh, that's the answer I was secretly hoping for.
So were the animatronic Deinonychus like your favorite part of the museum, or were you just, I don't know, running around everywhere?
I was running around everywhere. And I think they were probably high on the list when you're a kid, especially when you're, you know, any other dinosaur kid, massively obsessed with Jurassic Park, destroying your VHS of The Lost World because you watched it too many times. But I don't remember them being my favorite parts. I remember always loving Iguanodon as a kid, just loved its skull and loved the skeleton.
That's very on brand for you.
It is very on brand for me. Aladar from the Disney Dinosaur movie. They had so much personality. They're great. But they had the model of Iguanodon, but it was still in like the early 1900s pose where it was kangaroo pose with like its tail bent backwards.
Where were the spikes?
Oh, they're on its thumb. We're not Richard Owening it with the, with the nose horn. Yeah. But that was always one of my favorites. I always remember the Triceratops tucked away in the corner was pretty cool. I always remember especially there was a one-to-one size model of a blue whale when I was a kid there. And yeah. I just remember it always going into that gallery, and maybe it's because you're little and everything seems bigger, but just being like, no, that's not possible, surely. That's nonsense, but alas.
And then at the time as well, there was Dippy.
There was. They've got their, I don't remember what their new blue whale's called, Grace or something, or Hope? Hope. Hope is their new blue whale they have in the foyer, but prior to that, it was Dippy. I don't know what's happened to Dippy. I know it went on tour. I don't know where it is now. Yeah.
Someone at me. Tell me where Dippy is. Send a photo as well, and bonus points if you get a selfie with it too.
Yes. Yeah. But I've not been back since I was a kid. But yeah, to sum it all back, yes, I loved the NHM. I don't remember there being particularly much in the way of natural history stuff where I grew up in Bristol, especially when I was in England.
Okay, but at what point did you dig up a rock in your garden?
Ah,
I think it was a dinosaur skull.
That rock is still on my desk to this day.
What?
Yeah.
Monash?
No, in my house.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a little slab of, it's like a sort of sandstone, but it's got like some shell fragments and stuff.
Okay. This makes me feel like a bit less judgmental of you being like, there's a dinosaur skull in here. If it's got some like white, shiny.
The thing I thought was a dinosaur skull was not a dinosaur skull. It's a mud clast. It's just got a hole in it. Like it's a long mud clast with a little hole in the middle of it. And I went, oh, it's a dinosaur. And then I took it to the NHM and they pulled a paleontologist out from behind the scenes to come meet me. I was so excited. I was like, oh, yeah. But to their credit, they took it off my hands. They wrote up a little report as to like, you know, it's got all these shell fragments in it. Couldn't possibly say the age because, you know, it's just an isolated rock from some kid's back garden in Barclay, Leicestershire. But, you know, here's your report with your LHM thing. It's like, thank you for bringing it in. And, you know, still got the certificate, still got the rock.
Yeah.
It was a huge...
You can't still have the rock and not have the paperwork.
Come on. It's in my special folder.
Excellent. But yeah, like all this to say, I guess as well, your parents have been like pretty supportive.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits. But then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelt Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
Yeah, it's always been a case of, you know, it's the thing you want to do. You should pursue it. And you should try to make yourself as happy as possible in your life.
Only have one life.
You only have the one.
And
yes.
The cradle to grave thing of having job security like doesn't really exist anymore for people our age.
Mm-mm.
And it's not for lack of trying. So you might as well do something you really enjoy and are passionate about.
Yeah, mum and dad were hugely supportive of anything I got myself into. I had a lot of interests growing up, not just dinosaurs. The constant through everything that I've ever done has been drawing. I've started drawing since I could hold a pencil, but I never really stopped. It's just the things I've drawn have changed a bit. And I think they've gotten a little better since I was five. But, you know, you be the judge of that. One in particular that we would always do is whenever you'd have a rainy day in Berkeley, where I used to live in England, which was often. It's England.
360 days?
It's 345. You know, okay. You get the odd sunny days. England does have some sunny days, unlike Scotland. But yeah, you'd always go out and you'd walk along the muddy tracks or all around the town. And obviously all the puddles would then fill and you'd have these huge puddles, which little kid Rory, he'd bring his little sketchbook along and I would say what the footprints were. I was doing imaginary ichnology, I guess.
Oh, okay. So you were actually saying that footprint, this puddle is a footprint of this dinosaur.
Yes.
Oh, I have always misunderstood it. I thought you were taking the shape and then drawing that and then turning that into a dinosaur body. Completely misunderstood for years.
That's way more creative and inventive than it actually was. It was literally just, oh, this is a really big three-toed looking footprint. This is a T-Rex and this one is bigger. So it is a Spinosaurus. That sort of stuff.
So you mentioned before you had a big dinosaur phase. Did you kind of get out of it?
Oh, 100%. High school? I had my dinosaur phase till I was about maybe 11 or 12. Sort of got into, you know, fantasy. A lot of my drawings turn from dinosaurs to dragons.
I mean, same.
Same, same.
Like when I was 8, I was obsessed with dragons.
Yeah.
And like I would get books on the library and read about all these different types. I didn't get dragonology.
You didn't get dragonology?
I don't think we could afford it.
Oh.
But I would go to the library and like get those things. So it's very like full circle moment for me to be working on pterosaurs because they're basically
the
dragons.
Yeah. The dragons of the Mesozoic, yes. I made a... I made an entire book thing for all of my classmates in England when I was growing up, and it was filled with dragon pictures where every single individual person who had to design each of their own dragons, and then my headmaster got it laminated and bound for me.
Oh,
yeah, little dork.
And now you're the same, you're just bigger.
Yeah.
I'm allowed to say that too, we're friends.
We're friends, yes. But yeah, beyond that, when I turned like 13, 14, I just stopped really being interested in natural history in general. I got really into racing cars and into like engineering and things like that.
Yeah.
I thought I wanted to be a car designer until I was like 17 years old or something like that. I got really into my art when I was at the end of high school. I thought I might want to do something with that. I thought I might want to do some writing. The first uni course I did was journalism and arts.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I did it for 6 months. Then I caught glandular fever and I saw that as the golden excuse to never do it again.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't know you had glandular fever.
Wasn't fun.
No, because it knocks you for like, what, 6 months?
It was longer? There were like 2 weeks where I was just lying on the sofa and my mum was apparently watching to make sure I didn't stop breathing.
My mum has also done that sometimes when I've been really sick. She's like, I was outside your door to make sure that you didn't stop breathing. It's like, cool, but I'm also just like, but what would you have done then?
Just punch you in the chest a bunch until something starts happening.
Yeah, break some ribs. Yeah. Call it CPR.
You get plenty of ribs. Don't worry about it. Yeah, I lived on ice cream those 2 weeks, so that was nice.
Ah.
Because I couldn't eat anything else.
Oh, no. It's upside to everything. So where was this first degree? Like the 6 months?
Oh, it would have been at Edith Cowan University, and it was the only university
I could... in Canada?
No, that is in WA.
Oh, okay.
So I did my year 12. I did year 11. I did up to year 11 in Victoria. Then we moved to WA, and I did year 12 there.
Hell of a time to move schools when everyone already has like their friendship groups and everything.
And I can use that as kind of my excuse for the eventual results I got from my PhD.
Yeah, what was your ATAR? And for anyone outside of Australia, it's your like final high school mark. And it determines like how you get into unis and stuff.
Yeah. I think it's literally like you just given a number and you are put on...
You're put on like the bell curve, I think.
Yeah. But does one person have a 1 and one person has a 100 and then everyone is in between? Or is it...
I'm not sure.
In any case, you're sort of aiming for like a 70 or an 80 to get into most unis.
Yeah.
I got 58.
And look at you now.
Yeah. The only uni that had...
Spoiler alert, I will bring this up later, but you got the best honours mark in your year level at Swinburne, and you're doing a PhD now in paleontology. So I just want to highlight this, as uncomfortable as you are with praise, but...
I would put a lot of my honours mark as well down to the excellent people who helped me as well, because I did have a terrific supervisor, Redeem, a particular your supervisor right now, Steve Barbett.
Yeah, shout out Steve from our episode on Savannosaurus.
Yep.
Steve put it beautifully though, and this is kind of a bit of a mind-bending concept considering we're paleos as well, but like past performance isn't always an indicator of future performance.
I hope not.
People can change. And
I mean, I embody that as well in my undergraduate as well. Well, my first year as an undergrad, I did not get good marks.
Well, you changed courses a few times, two or?
Three.
Okay. Is that, and I think this is probably a healthier thing rather than being 16 years old and being asked to try and decide what you want to do for the rest of your life, because I wouldn't be here today. I wouldn't be working in the paleontology community if I hadn't given it a go, because I never considered it as like a career path.
Yeah. If you'd asked me at 10 years old, mm-hmm. what do you want to be? Paleontologist, hands down. I wrote letters to paleontologists, I think.
Who?
Well. I can't remember. Oh. I just know that, like, I know that I...
If anyone's listening to this and they received a...
I'm sorry.
A letter from Rory
Duncan. I think
Rory
I probably
Duncan.
Drew you a picture as well.
Oh, the best.
But yeah, no, it was never something I seriously considered as an option either. Because yeah, Edith Cowan, 68-hour requirement, so I got in because of my 58. I didn't really want to do it. And then I moved to Canada for a year and I worked minimum wage at a golf course. And then I saved up all the money I'd made and I moved back to Victoria to do outdoor education.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Which is a PE degree.
Yeah.
Didn't like it. Like, one of my favorite things to do for holidaying is me and my good friend Adam will tend to do big cycle tours.
Yeah.
You just chuck everything onto a bicycle and then head out into the wilderness for a week or two or three. It's awesome fun. I was like, yeah, I could do that, but I get paid for it. And then I found out I basically just had to become a PE teacher and I didn't like it. Fundamentally, I think it wasn't for me, and it's something I enjoy, but it's not something I want to do professionally. But it was a first year unit on geology that I did as one of my electives. And, oh, I can't remember her name. Oh, no.
You can tell me later and I'll edit it back in.
Well, this terrific lecturer, the whole unit was, here is a basic history of life on Earth and how Earth has come to be. You know, here's a description of the geologic processes that created the world. Here's a history of things that evolved on Earth. And I remember just sitting in the lecture theater going, oh, I used to love this. Why am I not doing this? And that was why the next semester I went to Monash to study geology and biology. But I still lived in Bacchus Marsh at the time. It is 2 hours in each direction. It is not a good time. I ended up not finishing, continuing after that semester. And then I went back to Federation with the stated goal of, I want to do paleo. And I mostly did geology because Federation University is a mining school. So
it's funny you say all this because I fell into paleontology as well through geology. And again, like, I had a really great lecturer for first year, Marian Anderson. And we had like a little taste of some paleo in that unit as well. Like, one of our assignments, I think we got 5 fossils each. And then I think some of the casts probably were made by Museums Victoria because there was like diprotodon teeth in there too. Nice. But it was, yeah, it was really cool. But it's,
and you were at Monash, weren't you?
Yeah. I did my undergrad at Monash. But yeah, it's just funny to think that, like, if I'd been lured into geology by hearing about their graduates getting 6-figure jobs, I wouldn't be doing like the thing that I'm actually passionate about.
Yeah.
And I've had that in undergrad, that moment of like a really good teacher just coming into your life at the right time. I had that with Marian, and then I was really lucky because I had that with Dr. Chris Mays, who then was my supervisor for honors too. So yeah.
By a similar token, a lot of the bioanatomy stuff I've had to learn.
Oh, you've had to pick it up throughout your PhD.
Yes.
Yeah, same.
It was not a component of my geology because Federation, every single other person that was there, they wanted to go to the mines, they wanted to work in those 6-figure jobs.
Yeah.
I was the only person that wanted to do something different as far as I can recall. But it was because of Stephen Carey, who is a paleontologist and geologist at Federation. He's done some work on diprotodon trackways with... I think he's worked with Gilbert Price and Aaron Cadens and stuff on some of their work.
Sounds about right.
I think so.
Aaron does that. Like marrying like tracks with the animals that made it.
Yeah,
and yeah.
Yeah,
he's definitely talked about diprotodon tracks before.
He's a cool fella, but he approached me in my final semester when I was doing his paleontology unit, which is mostly on foraminifera at Federation, which are these tiny little...
They're like shells, like tiny, tiny shells from plankton, I want to say.
they make up most of rocks in a lot of places as well.
There's like whole layers called the Globigerina ooze, which is a genus.
Yeah.
And they're useful for oil and gas industry.
Pew! Hey, Adele coming in hot. Okay, so foraminifera, there are both benthic and planktonic foraminifera. So they're both free swimming and they also live on the bottom of the ocean. According to the British Geological Survey, foraminifera are amoeba-like single-celled protists, in brackets, very simple microorganisms. That's all you need to know. Let's not get too hung up on definitions. Let's get back to Ruri.
Yep. And they're hugely useful for interpreting paleo environment and things of that
nature. They're very beautiful as well. Like, they have such intricate little things. They're beautiful.
I was bored of the microscope by the end of that unit. However,
microscope work can be intense, though.
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, it's good that I work on big vertebrate fossils.
Yeah, and you experience it and you're like, actually, I don't want to do this. Part of paleontology, too. But he approached you.
Yes. I had, at the start of that semester, been pestering Tim Ziegler here at Museums Victoria to do an internship as a volunteer.
Yep.
Because I've been volunteering front of house for years.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, when did you start volunteering?
In like 2016.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was after I'd gone to Winton.
Yeah. I was volunteering front of house, mostly...
Doing whatever I could to try and get a foot in the door.
Yeah.
Which is very smart as well. And I think I got that same advice in undergrad too.
Did you do front of house?
No.
Oh.
No, wow. I did inverts with Rolf Schmidt, who's also here today. Thanks, Rolf.
Thank you, Rolf. He let us in.
Yes.
But yeah, that was for like 2 years. But it was only after having the internship as an excuse at Federation, I kind of kept pestering Tim to let me volunteer in the collections. So I did for that semester, but also during that semester, Steve and Carrie approached me and said, hey, would you like to do a third year research project? Because I have some ideas about these echinological structures and
these footprints.
Not just footprints.
Oh.
There's also some hypothetical burrows as well in Victoria, which basically the idea was either there are these footprints at Skeens Creek or these potential burrows in this very hard to access area. So we drove down the Otways for like two or three separate days, met Mike Cleland, the discoverer of Coelacanthus clelandi from episode 2, who showed us where these footprint tracks were. It was the first time I met him and his partner Pip. It was really, really good. And it was that coupled with my internship, which was my sort of first foot in the door with Victorian paleo, and I have forced the rest of my body through after my foot after that.
Sometimes you have to, like, you have to show that you're keen, because it's awesome that you got approached to do like a third year research project. Mm-hmm. I regret not doing one actually in undergrad, because I think I would have enjoyed it. Different unis will maybe have exams or whatever, but you just get to be in charge of your own project.
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, I find it hard sometimes when it's just like, okay, I'm just learning this for the sake of memorizing it.
Well, that was anything that was in any way paleo related in my entire undergrad degree, I did to excess. I remember there was a second year bio thing where we had to do a like 10-minute presentation on a biological function or something of that nature. I did a 25-minute edited video on the evolution of flight invertebrates and invertebrates.
Oh, my gosh. That is amazing. I hope it still exists.
It does, but I definitely don't want to show it to anyone because
it's
garbage.
I'll piss you
mostly off. Just my narration. I listen back. It's like, and sometimes they would flap their wings like this, and it would be... I've gotten a little bit more confident since I made that video, I think. And it was the same thing with the third year research project. It was describing these 8 different footprints in the Skeens Creek area. And
did you go ham? Did you go overboard?
I went overboard.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah. Like, it was approached at KVIPS last week, and apparently...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Someone's read it.
Like, I didn't think anyone beyond my examiners would ever read it.
Like, it's not online.
No.
It's not like I could Google it and find it.
So, obviously, as with almost all Victorian paleo...
it's a small community and, like, people tend to know each other.
Yes. And largely a lot of the collections and the things that are discovered in Victoria's coasts in particular are found by people taking time out of their own days and their own lives to go and collect and look for these things.
90% of that is Melissa Lowry.
And the Victorian Victorian Cretaceous, yes, everything that Jake's PhD project is working on is almost exclusively the work of Melissa Lowry. It's the same with Jangjuk, though, where the fossils I study now come from. It's the same in Skeens Creek, where my footprint tracks are. There's a person working there right now, Tim Wagstaff.
Oh, yeah, they were at the conference.
They were at the conference, too. Yeah, and they approached me and they're like, yeah, Mike Cleland sent me your third year research report. And I was reading through it and here are my thoughts on it. I was like, oh, cool. Because I remember my examiners, my third year research project, was going, all right, cool, dinosaurs. Nice. Because I think most of them are geologists and biologists. Or
yeah, they didn't necessarily have like a background.
Yeah.
It was just whoever they had at the uni to be like, you're marking this today.
Yes.
Cool. So went from doing 30 research project footprints and then, yes, came up to help relocate a whole bunch. Like, I think altogether, well, it was like 100 tons
of
rock altogether that was shifted. Yeah. 100 tons of rock moved 100 kilometers away. Yeah. First kind of bit.
Yeah, I've never been back since. I've never seen the new building. I'd love to. Yeah. But we did it in two separate years.
Yeah, the Dinosaur Dreaming team like first came up to help relocate some of the footprints. We were still like figuring it out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then some of the track site, the rock layer is actually quite thin.
It was a huge logistical undertaking, to say the least.
Yeah.
But it was really, really cool to be part of that. And it was really, really cool to meet all these excellent people such as yourself when I was up there. Yeah, didn't love the drive both ways, but, you know, it was an interesting road trip. I don't think I'll ever be in the position where I'll have Steve Parapet, Tim Ziegler, and Tom Rich in the same car as me again, 3 days.
A wild time. So, yeah, you did that. You came back, but then you said you were like sort of between unis at that point?
So the problem with, I ended up doing 5 units in my last year of undergrad.
Okay.
Which was fun because I didn't plan to do the research project. I added it on to the end.
Oh, right.
So I ended up finishing and having an extra unit in the end, but I was done halfway through the year. And so I then had to like decide what I was going to do after that. And it was trying to find an honors project. And I remember, I think I emailed, I'm sorry if anyone who listens to this podcast got an email from me in late 2018 saying, hello, please let me work on fossils. I'd love to.
I sent a bunch of emails like that too. I think you have to. And sometimes people don't get back to you and stuff where they're just like, your marks aren't great, which is what happened to me.
It was what I was saying earlier. I got quite good marks later on in my undergraduate, third year and my third and a half year. There was quite a few good marks in there. But my first year, I failed chemistry 101. I had to do it twice. I didn't get great marks in my first year. It was a very P's get degrees.
Yeah.
Especially when it was doing like mining geology. It was hard to make myself care about things that were ultimately not related to paleo, hard rock geology, things like that.
Yeah. No, I was very much the same. Even though like I wanted to love it because at Monash, the geology department at the time had like a big focus on structural geology and geophysics. I can't think in three dimensions. It's a learned thing. If I'm learning anatomy, you know, it has to be through practice. Mm-hmm. It's not an immediate thing for me.
I didn't do all the mining geology stuff as well. I think I technically don't have a geology degree. I have like a environmental geoscience degree, ecology as well as part of my undergrad.
That makes sense.
Most of my electives were vet science or ecology.
You got to do vet science?
Only for 2 semesters.
Oh, that's still cool though. I would have loved that.
Yeah. Didn't understand any of the molecular biology stuff, but I tried my best. But yeah, no, for like half a year, I was just scrambling, trying to find where I wanted to do my honors. And thank goodness I ran into Steve Parapet.
Dino Dad.
I went and met with Steve at some point in 2018 and said what I was interested in, what I really wanted to do, the things I was most interested in. I think I especially brought up Antarctica because Antarctica is my favorite thing in the world, as goes paleo and everything else, because the polar regions are the coolest place on Earth. And I didn't technically really have the marks for it. To do honors, I needed to have a higher grade point average for my undergrad. I was below the threshold, not by much, but I was below it. But bless him, took a chance on me. And as you said, I did quite well in my honors as well. So it worked out, I think. I got this excellent grounding and everything to do with Victorian paleo and how to work on geology, how to work in anatomy, how to describe specimens. And it meant that I got my first authored publication out of it.
Yeah, published in JVP. So your honors project was on ornithopod dinosaurs.
It was. The vast majority of the fossils we find here in Cretaceous Victoria are these little ornithopod dinosaurs.
Before I ask you more questions, can I be rude and interject?
Please.
I've known you for so long, but there's so many parallels I didn't know about because I technically didn't have the right marks to get into PhD either. And Steve took a chance on me and Pat Vickers-Rich as well.
There's many parallels. When was your race car phase?
I think I'm going to have it when I'm 40.
Yeah, all right.
I'll let you know when it happens.
I'm looking forward to it. I've got so many things to talk to you about.
Okay, great. getting back on track, let's talk about some paleo. You're now working on whales, but you were working on ornithopod dinosaurs.
I was.
And there's quite a few from Victoria.
There are. As I said, they're actually kind of where my first love as a kid.
Iguanodon.
Well, as well as the little book I made of everyone's favorite dragons, I wrote a story.
That's right.
I wrote a storybook when I was like six, I think, about Injigogo, who was an iguanodon who was little, and he went around and made all these friends. I don't think there was much of a story. I think it was mostly just these weird and wacky characters where he wanted to draw and put together into a book. But yes, I liked ornithopods as a kid. As I said, Iguanodon was always my favorite, partly due to, I think, Disney Dinosaur. Did you ever watch that one?
No.
You haven't watched Disney Dinosaur?
I still haven't watched Walking with Dinosaurs 2.
Oh my goodness, stop. Adele. Oh. All right.
I'll get there.
You're going to get your paleo card revoked.
I know. Am I dead to you?
You're not dead to me, but you know, the clock's ticking.
Okay, great.
Disney's Dinosaur, the protagonist is a fish out of water iguanodon who uses the power of friendship and cooperation to save the day, basically. It's got these massive Carnotauruses in it. They made them stupidly big. Jake loves them.
Of course he does.
They're ridiculous, but they're awesome. And the iguanodon has so much expression. You had like the big brutish ones. You had the nice, elegant, slender ones. And they're cool because they're ornithopods, but they can tell you to bop off because you got these big thumb spikes. So, yes, most of Australia's, well, Victoria in particular's fossil fauna is composed here of these ornithopods. But they wouldn't have gotten to the size of something like iguanodon. The biggest ones you probably would have seen would have been, I don't know, 4 feet at the hip. They would not have been very tall.
Pew! By the way, 4 feet is equal to 1.2 meters.
Yeah, it's weird because Muttaburrasaurus is quite
just
large,
just
in Queensland. Yeah. But
I mean, it's weird as well because we would have been at, I think, 70-ish degrees south at the time when these rocks are being laid down. And at that point, it's not the only high latitude fossil site we know of. We know of other ones like the very famous Prince Creek Formation and the Arctic.
That you're obsessed with.
I love the Prince Creek Formation. It's got my favorite ceratopsian from it as well, Pachyuranosaurus.
That was in Prehistoric Planet 2, which I did watch
on
the plane on the way to PDU3.
On the plane.
Yeah.
It's fine. They did a lot of Prince Creek stuff in both Prehistoric Planet 1 and 2. I appreciate it a lot. Again, anything polar is my favorite thing in the world, which is why it was such a privilege to get to work on the Victorian ornithopods. But yeah, they're all small. There's nothing that breaks this tiny body size thing, which is weird because in the Prince Creek Formation, we find Lambiosaurs and Edmontosaurs.
That's late Cretaceous as well,
Victoria's
more early Cretaceous.
It is. So the global temperature is different. The conditions they're living under are different. Both Victoria and the Prince Creek are in a much warmer world than we have today, where you would have had no permanent ice at the poles. But it's
they had months of continuous dark.
Yeah, you'd still dealing with those polar conditions. They would have been living here and 3 months at least of continuous dark and light, which is crazy to think on. But you find these tiny, tiny little ones. We find juveniles here. So we know they are reproducing in this area. But one of the weirder things is they seem to all be from this group of Gondwanan ornithopods called the Elasmerians. We find them in South America and Antarctica, and we find them here. But they seem weirdly diverse here. We have 5 named ornithopods from here in Victoria. But there are issues with that taxonomy to do with...
Taxonomy! It's a mess!
It's partly just a result of how incomplete the fossils are, because they're all from this giant river valley that would have been smashing all their fossils to pieces. So if you get a jawbone which has anything associated with it, that's probably one of the most complete ornithopod skull fossils we'll find in the state. So yes, Lealinosaur was first named here in 1989 by Tom and Pat Rich, along with Atlascopcosaurus, mostly just known from the upper jaws with a little bit of the brain case for Lealinosaur. But the reason I mentioned the long tail is, we have this massive tail fossil that was found on the same day at the same dig site. And we don't know that it necessarily belongs to the Lealinosaur, but it's weird. No other ornithopod that we've ever found has a tail that is as long as the rest of its body or longer.
So more than half its body is tail.
Yes.
Okay. I've seen like some paleo like fan art or reconstructions, and they show the tails.
There's a lot of
doing. There seems to be like a lot of movement implied.
Yeah.
I don't know how much scientific backing is in that though.
My honors degree was on the jawbones of ornithopods from a site called Eric the Red West.
To try and sort out the taxonomy a little bit.
To try and just like, because we had so much new material that hadn't been described.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because Eric the Red West is a relatively new site. There's a researcher, Matt Hearn. He did a terrific PhD thesis where he went through all of the Victorian material, and he described a lot of the tail vertebrae. extremely long one. I wish I knew more about it because as I recall, I think there's a lot of tendons in it. So I suspect it probably wasn't as bendy as it's sometimes reconstructed.
Right. So ossified tendons. Ossified tendons. That's sick. I didn't realize that was there.
Don't quote me on this. Maybe you have to take this whole thing out. But in any case, yeah, we have weird anatomies going on here and we have a lot of variety in the jaw bones as well. In my honors project, I've had at least three different distinct upper skull bones in one site in Victoria, which is weird. They've got these three different animals that seem to all be doing broadly the same thing, all living in this area. Maybe just because there's little in the way of other herbivorous dinosaurs around, they're able to niche partition and spread into all these different feeding techniques and have these different teeth and different jaws to reflect that.
Yeah. What do the teeth look like? Are they described as leaf-shaped or is that a completely different group?
Leaf-shaped, I think you'd usually use that for like hadrosaurs where they're like these...
Well, they have dental batteries.
Yeah, and... they're just... Their teeth have teeth. They're teeth on teeth on teeth on teeth on teeth. Whereas the teeth of the Victorian arthropods are...
Are they ridges?
Yeah. They are nothing but ridges. One say they're kind of... spatulate, you would say. They broaden to the top and they are covered in these ridges that go all the way along the length of the tooth. But there's a lot of variety in these and that is a lot of what we separate them on taxonomically. So you have the big chunky ones we usually put to Atlas Copcosaurus and you have these much more simple ones which have ridges on both sides, which we tend to ascribe to Lialanosaur. And I got to describe the first adult Lialanosaur. As it turns out, the holotype is a juvenile. Hooray!
And then as a juvenile, well... Juveniles as holotypes can be a little bit problematic because they can have characters that they grow out of. Mm-hmm. So, and I think with Lialanosaur in particular, it was like big orbits. Back in the day, it was proposed that it was like an adaptation for living in low light conditions. Yes. But it's probably just because she's young.
Yeah. Ultimately, the Tom Rich quote, the best fossil is a fossil you have.
I'm going to make a bingo card one day, and it's just going to be like Adele quote Simpsons, Tom Rich's quote. I need to make it.
But fundamentally, with the stuff they'd dynamited out of the side of the cliff. And
oh, yeah, dinosaur dreaming back in the day, dynamiting into Dinosaur Cove.
So cool. I wish I was there. But with the stuff they had, like, how could they have known that that was juvenile morphology necessarily? I think they make reference to it, but ultimately, it's only with more fossils you can see. You know, they expand their tooth counts from like 12 to 15 as they get older.
Oh, that's a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah. We saw that in Galeanosaurus, and it seems to be the same thing in Lialanosaurus as well. Their jaws get longer and more full of teeth as they get older because they're always replacing their teeth anyway.
Yeah, I guess you might as well make use of that real estate.
Yeah.
And try and eat your food properly.
Yep, but these short-snouted, large-eyed animals, it was originally put forward that that was potentially an adaptation to low-light conditions, which would have been the case.
Yeah.
But it's potentially the fact that the Lialanosaur holotype, which has the bottom of the eye socket preserved, which is massive, that could more be to do with the fact that it is a juvenile animal and all of the juvenile arthropods we've ever found have these massive eye sockets. But there's nothing to say that they don't retain that into adulthood. A neotic trait?
Pedomorphic?
Pedomorphic. Damn, I should know that word.
You mentioned it last week.
I did mention it last week. It's a big part of my PhD thesis. Goodness. Anyway, yes, potentially they're retaining that big eye socket into adulthood, but we don't necessarily know because most of the fossils we find are really, really fragmentary. Yeah. So.
If you want to read more about that, you published it in the Journal of Vertebrate
JBP in 2021. That was one of the few highlights of my pandemic. Yeah.
On that note, let's have a tea break and then we'll refresh and then I'll ask you about the dark times
and then
we'll move on to whales and talk about whaleontology.
Woo!
Okay, be right back. And we're back.
Hello.
Feeling a lot better now that we've had a cup of tea.
Caffeine.
Oh, highly dependent on it. So good. And while we were having a tea break, I mean you,
yes.
Fact checked yourself,
yes,
which
I
is
did.
Great because yes. It's saving me so much homework later on.
So the lecturer who in my first year of uni got me back into paleo in general was Nicole Cox, who is no longer at Federations, it turns out. But thank you, Nicole.
Oh, and then Jake told me, I found out from another friend of ours, Jack O'Connor, that Marian Anderson is actually going to be retiring.
Oh.
sometime next year. And hopefully that wasn't a secret, but anyway.
I hope it isn't, but we can find out and we can cut it out if it isn't.
Can't wait to get angry emails.
I'd also, yeah, Jess Reeves as well was the other person in my third year of uni. She is a invertebrate paleontologist who works on ostracods and was a big part of like realizing this is even a possibility as well.
Yeah.
And owe her a lot. Greatly appreciate it. As for the other thing I was looking up, though,
yes.
I was desperately trying to, because as I said, most of my ornithopod work has been on skulls. I have read lightly on their tails and postcrania.
I do the same thing too with pterosaurs, where I don't learn the anatomy
of the stuff you don't have.
I don't have.
Yeah.
You know, work smarter, not harder. I'm super lazy.
So am I. As I understand it, I don't think there's ossified tendons down the whole length of the Leallinosaur tail, and it extends the caudal vertebrae in terms of their whole body, their whole length. They're weird.
And then what, the length of the tail was like a meter?
The length of the tail was a meter long, estimated. That's
and the rest of the body?
A bit less than a meter, but over a meter.
That's nuts.
Yeah. Crazy.
Wild.
There's an excellent reconstruction in the speculative reconstruction book All Yesterdays by Darren Nash, C.M. Cosman, and John Conway, where they did Leallinosaur reconstruction and they do them these little white puffballs with like a little yellow tuft on the end of their tail. And they hold them up in the... Yeah.
I didn't know like Darren Nash was connected to that. That's
no,
sick.
No, it was a project they did in like 2013, 2014, I think, or something like that. I love that book. When I did my last paleo art, talked about my paleo art to people, I was talking about the process of making paleo art, and I was explaining shrink wrapping, and I used the pictures at the end of that book where they've got like modern animals reconstructed as...
Oh, that's from them
Yeah.
Oh, I just thought it was a meme.
No, I'm the worst. the murder swans, the shrink wrap cat, the hippo.
Yeah.
They're all from All Yesterdays.
Okay, yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, I believe they're from All Yesterdays. I'm almost certain they're from All Yesterdays.
I have no idea what that sound was.
It's okay. This place is haunted.
Rattling.
If honestly,
we're surrounded by so many bones.
Yeah. There's
we should
ghosts.
Be haunted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you sit in the photo lab next door, then you can always just hear birds because there's a chimney. It goes straight up to the flume. And
oh, of course. Because they've got like the hood is it like sodium? I'm going to say
ammonium chloride.
Ammonium chloride. I was going to say sodium chloride. I'm like, that is salt.
That's something else.
No,
that's
something else. It's salt. It's table salt.
It doesn't bad make chemist. Don't put that all over your fossils. It won't make them look better.
Speaking of chemistry as well. Oh no, it's just a bad segue because you said you didn't do biology.
Oh no, yeah, 12, no. I didn't do it in year 11 either. Year 10 was my last year of high school biology. In year 11, I went to doing chemistry and physics. And in year 12, I just did physics because in my car and airplane phase, I was massively interested in space. Still, I'm massively interested in space and astrology and things. Astrology, that's something else. Astronomy.
Ornithopods in retrograde.
Ornithopods in retrograde. Yes. So I was like, I'll do space science. I must learn physics. I was very bad at physics.
Physics was my worst subject.
I was so bad at physics. Oh, I failed physics in my final year of high school.
I didn't fail, but it was my worst subject and it didn't count towards my final mark. Thank goodness.
Well, but I did the hardest English unit and the hardest maths unit as well.
Oh, you
and
did lit?
Yeah, I did literature and I did
maths. I did
maths,
literature too.
Yeah, and I did maths methods, which was the harder one. And I did terribly in both and was one of the lowest in the class. So scaling, where they put you on that bell curve knock you down, meant that I had no English competency when I finished high school.
I did really bad in methods too.
Oh, God.
I just managed to scrape by and 30 was my goal, was like the prerequisite to get into science at Melbourne University, which is a course I didn't get into anyway because my marks were too low overall. So yeah,
you were trying to get in Melbourne.
I wanted to do vet science.
I didn't know that.
I wanted to be a vet.
Oh.
If you asked me, like until I was age 18, I wanted to be a vet and now I work on dead animals and if they break, I just fix them with glue. So yeah, we just neatly summed up like all the stuff that we realized we meant to mention over tea. And where we left off before we had like a quick break was the dark time. Mm. So yeah, you finished your honours and then it was just COVID in Melbourne. So pretty intense.
It was very intense. I remember...
And you were in a big share house too.
That was the best part. At the end of my honours...
So what year is this?
2019.
Okay.
I got to go to SVP and it was in Australia.
Oh yeah.
My
oh
honors
my
year.
Gosh.
I've
that's
never
right.
felt more imposter syndrome in my entire
you
life.
You were great though. You gave like a presentation, like your first conference, all these international big names had come over.
Yes, I know.
And you did like this 10 minute presentation and then you were on before Dr. Steve Salisbury who presented on a very exciting fossil, which we're still waiting to get a full description of. But you had to also deal with just the distraction of all these people like coming into the room. And so if you've never been to a conference before, it depends on who's running it. But the rules for SVP were if you came into the room, you had to line up on the back wall,
yes,
wait for a break in speaker, and then you could get a seat.
Mm-hmm. That was in the dinosaur sessions.
Yeah, so one of the many dinosaur sessions.
There were three dinosaur sessions. But they were always well attended because, you know, dinosaurs. And yeah, I remember looking up at the back periodically whilst I'm up the front going, so as you can see, and just the room was getting progressively more busy as the talk following mine was quite a big one. So yeah.
You did great.
Thank you.
Except for that moment where you forgot to acknowledge
the supervisors. Oh. Like again, Everyone's first proper conference. And yeah, I completely forgot to have an acknowledgement slide at the end. And then I saw Steve, who was moderating my session. I think the last thing I said in my talk was, I'm a bad person, so yes. I don't want to have an acknowledgement slide.
That was great.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the end of 2019. I got my honors handed in, got my good mark.
The best.
Shut up. Got my...
You're welcome. I'm not actually here to interview. I'm here to embarrass you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's like having my mum here again.
We can get her on the phone.
She would love to be on the phone. Yes. Anyway.
Madge, if you're listening, hi.
She'll listen. Hi, mum. But then, yeah, I wrote a 50-minute talk about all of the polar dinosaurs ever found for like the field gnats. Actually, I gave that talk twice. That was great. And that last time I gave it was in February 2020. And I remember thinking, things are on the up and up. This is great. I'm going to get an honors project and a PhD project. It'll be great. Unfortunately, the nature of the precarity of the profession means that Steve, my honor supervisor, wasn't necessarily able to offer a PhD position because he was...
His contract was ending at Swinburne because he would have loved to have you and supervise you in dinosaurs.
I would have loved to have
PhD.
Him. And it would have been potentially working more on our ornithopods and doing more with our Australian record, which is work that needs to continue to be done because at the moment it's criminally understudied, I think, as with a lot of Victorian paleo.
Australian paleo.
But it was a case of waiting to find out. He would have been like accessory supervisor to...
Oh yeah, an external supervisor or something like that. Yeah.
Personally, considering how extensive the work of Matt Hearn's thesis was in 2014, which had been published afterwards, I was a little tentative because I didn't know if it would be a lot of retreading existing work, but it was a potential option. But again, it was kind of like up in the air as to whether or not it would even be an option. So I went around and looked at other places as well.
Oh yeah, because we tried to get you to chat with Patrick Druckenmiller at Patrick SVP.
Chat with Patrick Druckenmiller at SVP.
Yeah.
Yeah, we exchanged a few emails, but I think the logistics of getting to Alaska in the first place would have been a hassle.
Tom Rich tells a great story about doing fieldwork in Alaska, rolling their car, and a bystander happened to pass by and said, "Oh, you guys are right." And thankfully, no one was injured. And I don't know if this is an Australian thing or not, but they were just like, "Yeah, we're fine." And then they drove off. Yeah. It's just like, hang on.
Yeah, we're fine. This happens all the time. The bears will push it back over.
Great. So, you're sort of not waiting for things to happen. You're trying to make stuff happen as well, but in really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, because obviously in March 2020, especially in Victoria, everything kind of gets shut down and everything is, all right, we'll come back to this when the pandemic is over in a few
months'
time.
Yeah, when there's a vaccine developed.
Yeah. So I was waiting until basically that. I was kind of keen for the time off. I worked on my honors project. I got it ready for publication.
Did a great job.
Shucks, thank you. But I was very productive, got a lot of work done in those first few months. I talked to people at Flinders. I talked to Trevor Worthy and Gavin Prideaux at Flinders about working on marsupials. But there was a potential project here at Melbourne Museum working on a very special fossil here, which didn't end up materializing with Eric Fitzgerald. But when that fell through, it was, you could work on cetaceans. Cetaceans being whales. Growing up as well, my mum is a massive marine biology nerd. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
There are books all over the house. We had like these dolphin statues all over the place.
I was too taken with like multiple Nessies.
Oh,
everywhere.
Yeah. Well, marine biology as well. Marine cryptozoology. But yes, mum was very into marine animals as a kid. And again, I always remember that blue whale at the NHM, but I was very keen to work on cetaceans at the auction came up because they are my favorite modern animals outside of things like polar bears and muskox. And they're all the coolest. Humpback whale, unequivocally the best animal on earth. Do not at me.
You can at him. He's Ruri.
Oh, you have to spell my name. Yeah,
It'll be in the title. I'll put links.
Sorry, it's Gaelic. I can't help it. I like it.
No, what's your Instagram handle? Is it
Ruri Duncan.
Oh, Ruri Duncan Art?
Nope, just Rory Duncan.
Oh,
yep.
Anyway,
I sometimes use the handle Inxcetus, I-N-X-C-E-T-U-S as well on other platforms.
Now, I've seen it before.
Yes.
And I don't know, is it...
There's a story there.
Yeah, what's the story?
When I was...
Is it Roman numerals? Oh, thank God. I'm really bad at them.
No. The story is when I got my PlayStation 3 when I was 12, I spent 2 days making up a name for myself on PlayStation because I wanted it to be really cool and wicked. So the name I came up with was Inxcion, which is I-N-X-E-C-C-I-O-N. And then I used that until I was doing my PhD and I thought, I need to modernize this. So I changed it to Inxcetus.
I love it when paleo people have like a portmanteau of their name or like their handle or something, but also it smashes together the group that they work on.
Yeah.
Because it just makes it so easy to be like, this person works
as
on this.
As a whale person. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, I was very keen to work on whales and that was my project that was posed with Eric Fitzgerald. However, it would not be starting until the...
Dark times lifted.
Dark times lifted and until Eric was available to supervise again, which would be after the Horridus project here at Melbourne Museum.
Yeah. Yes, the Triceratops.
Mm. Which was a big project, as I understand it. So that
getting it over here from the States because Australia does not have
any Triceratops.
There's
some controversy there.
Let's not get into it.
Anyway, but that would mean waiting to the end of the year. I messaged Ewan Fordyce, who got back to me very quickly, the very nice email. Really wanted to meet him. He seems like he was a really cool dude.
Yeah, from the conference as well, it seemed like he really had a big impact on like a lot of people.
Yep, yeah.
Like a great mentor.
Yep, that's the impression I get. But yeah, my limited interaction with him through an email, I would love to supervise you. I'm retiring.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Sometimes when you're just trying to find something, even those like little glimmers of I'd love to take you on, but sometimes they're just enough to give you enough hope to keep going and send the next email.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's rough, like getting just rejected over and over again.
Yeah, slowly the options whittled down until it was a case of I was either going to work with Tom and Pat Rich with Steve as a sort of semi-paleo-employed person, or at the time he was going to work in a secondary school because he had
given
up.
That's right, he was doing the teaching degree.
Yeah. I'm very grateful to the lab you work with now for giving him the position he has because he's now my parents' best friend, apparently.
Yes,
lives over
gosh.
In WA at Curtin University.
Yeah. They like live
you live two streets from my parents, yes.
Yeah. I'm super grateful too. And I'd love to give a shout out to Heidi Allen because when Professor Clady Grice was trying to figure out which paleo person she wanted in her lab, I think she spoke to people who work at the Geological Survey of Western Australia and Heidi could not recommend him highly enough. And
rightly so.
Yeah. I got to thank her in person at PDU3 too and just say, you have no idea how much of a difference this has made.
Yeah, definitely. I'm so glad that it's managed to mean that Steve Poirpat is still working in paleo, and I'm glad that it's given stability to Jake.
And your mom has an adopted granddaughter.
And my mom has an adopted granddaughter, Steve's daughter as well, yes. And Jake as well is obviously Steve's new PhD student and is doing amazing work as well on theropods, which is great to see.
We love to see it.
We love to see it. But yeah, alas, though I still am trying to work on some Mesozoic stuff in my downtime and secret, I am primarily a paleontologist now.
Yeah.
But those 2 years were awful. I developed my digital art to some degree, I think. I made the artwork for the Elaphrosaur paper. Yeah. I made the artwork for the Fair Draco paper. I obviously finished my honors thesis and got it published, which was really good. But yeah, I was lucky that I was living with five of my best friends over in Melton because I would have gone stir crazy otherwise. Yeah. That and my close friend Cassia, who was also always there.
To circle back to publishing, was it a case of you should definitely publish before you get started to make it easier for applications?
Don't know if that was said to me explicitly.
Okay.
But I think it was definitely a consideration, especially.
It doesn't hurt.
Well, especially in the lab I'm in now, the Evans Evermorph lab. I always am kind of surprised that Al Evans took me on as a PhD student because the stuff that is mostly done by the people in that, the lab is full of some of the most talented and scientifically rigorous people I've ever met in my entire life. It's very odd to count myself among them. Basically, with that level of imposter syndrome, having a publication, having, I think at that point, 2 co-authorships helped a lot with my application, as well as the honors marks. And I got, a reference from the head of honors at Swinburne University, where I did my honors as well, which was good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So whales, finally, let's talk about some fossils.
We got there eventually.
Yeah, aside from dinosaurs and stuff.
Yeah.
So you're now not working on stuff from the Mesozoic.
Much.
Okay, let's just put it behind us, your main project. Let's not talk about your side girl. Let's talk about your main girl, which is whales. Significantly younger.
Yes, they are.
How old are we talking about?
Well, okay, so the stuff we have here in Australia, we're actually kind of frustrated by how
Australians mad at the fossils they have to work with. Unheard of.
So with the exception of a single fossil, which we can't diagnose beyond like broad, it is a baleen whale.
Why's Australia like this?
Every single whale fossil, the oldest whale fossils in Australia are from the latest Oligocene. And that's
how many millions of years is that?
About 23 to 24 million years old, the age of the very famous Victorian whales, Mammalodon and Gengisetus. We have casts of them in this room with us here.
Terrible for podcasting. Anyway, we'll get some great photos with them later. And they're most of like the fossil whales in Australia, are they mostly this group called mammalodontids? No.
Most of the baleen whales. So
okay, let's talk whales. So we have toothed whales and we have ones that don't have teeth.
Yes. So whales evolved actually about 10 million years after the extinction of the dinosaurs, we think. We had their first ancestors, things like Pachycetus and Ambulocetus, which are these really early four-legged animals that would have looked kind of a bit like a dog or a wolf. They were relatively small and they would have been expanding into that niche space, which was completely laid vacant by the extinction of the
marine reptiles.
Yeah. Things like your mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and such. And they mostly lived in freshwater environments, but it's within a very short period of time, they start losing the ability to live on land. The hips become disarticulated from the vertebral column, and they start by the Eocene, about 35, 40 million years ago. The whole world is full of whales, but they're mostly this group called the basilosaurs, which is a lizardish name, does mean king lizard, but that was because when it was first found in the 1800s, they thought it was a reptile. Based on his teeth. Yeah, yeah. And it was proposed by Richard Owen to be renamed Zeuglodon, yolk tooth.
But that's a terrible name.
It's a terrible name. I know Basilosaurus isn't accurate, but it's such a cool name.
Yeah, I enjoy the mystique and energy that it brings as opposed to whatever. Yoki?
Yolk tooth. Come
on. That just makes me think of an egg.
Yeah, right? I think it's because it's like a Y. It's rubbish. Anyway, by the end of the Eocene, whales are found everywhere on Earth, going from like completely based on land animals to fully aquatic and living in all the world's oceans in about 10 to 12 million years. It's a rapid rate of evolution.
That's a lot. And is the fossil record for this transition like pretty well understood? Is there a missing link?
We don't really know when our two modern groups kind of evolved, which is the main thing. So
that's like the big research question, I guess, holy grail fossils to find.
We kind of, there's no definitive answer, you know? So
it's shades of gray, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's three primary groups of cetaceans. You've got archaeocetes, mysticetes, and odontocetes. And the archaeocetes are what we call a paraphyletic group, meaning that the modern lineages of whales, the baleen whales and the toothed whales, are evolved from this ancestral group, but there's no like end point to them. As I understand it, they're a paraphyletic group, and it's from this archaeocete lineage you get the evolution from the last common ancestor as an archaeocete, which gave rise to the two living groups of whales that we have today, which are the odontocetes, the toothed whales. So that's your dolphins, sperm whales, beaked whales, and porpoises. Those are all toothed whales, and they make up most of the diversity of cetaceans today. And mysticetes, the ones I love very deeply, are the baleen whales. And they're notable for mysticete literally means moustache whale.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Okay, I was thinking before, as you're saying all these names, I'm like, how am I going to remember this?
Yeah, you know, moustache whale.
I can't forget that. That's incredible.
It's fantastic. And it literally, and it's quite apt because they're named for this structure in their upper jaw, their baleen plate. And they are made from a keratinous material, the same material your fingernails and your hair is made from. It's thought in the most recent sort of studies I've read that it's effectively modified gum tissue.
Oh, I was going to say whiskers. I was really hoping for whiskers. Damn it, gum tissue.
Modern whales do have whiskers as well.
That's right, because whales have hair being mammals.
If you look in the rostrum or the end of the snout of a right whale, and I think some dolphins, they have got these little hairs all along the end of them.
Very cool.
Very cool. So it's not that weird that we would find baleen derived from this tissue, because if you look in things like their closest relatives, the ungulates, so that's hippos and cows and
like
such,
hooved
and
animals.
Deer. course. Yep. They're specifically even-toed ungulates. So they're the two-toed hoofed animals. Whales all are technically are all hoofed animals. There's a fun way of looking at it is it's the reversal of what we see on land. The ungulates are the predators of the carnivores, things like seals. When you see like an orca hunting a seal.
Oh my gosh, right? How the tides have turned.
How the turntables.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, yeah. But they're hoofed animals that have completely adapted to life on water. It may have been their earliest ancestors actually did have hooves as well when they were transitioning back to water. There is an early like stem cetacean called Indohyas, which seems to have been this little deer-like hoofed animal that lived in Pakistan and India at the time in the Eocene.
If you've seen videos of like moose swimming and hippos underwater too, you can kind of go like, okay, I can connect the dots and see how they, some of them would just be like, I like doing this quite a bit more than I like being on land.
Yeah. That basically seems to have been the way they thought or the way they ended up evolving. And hippos are actually the closest living ancestors of whales today. They form a group together, sometimes called Whippomorpha, which is fun. So this last common ancestor was an Archaeocene, and it gave rise to the first baleen whales and the first toothed whales. And my research is mostly focusing on just this bit right after this evolution of this last common ancestor. This is about a 5 to 10 million year period where baleen whales go bananas. You get all sorts of different morphologies all throughout this time period called the Oligocene. But we see them diversify all throughout, specifically the Pacific. You have my favorite toothed baleen whale. So they would have had teeth, all of these early baleen whales. And you see things like the Yanacetids, which got to the size we think of bigger than a modern minke whale, possibly up to about 12 meters in size in the Eocene, which is crazy big for an early baleen whale.
Pew! And 12 meters is equal to 39 feet.
And they're found in Antarctica, and they were found by expedition, which included Ewan Fordyce as well. One of the coolest bits of field work I can ever imagine doing, finding a giant fossil baleen whale skull in Antarctica.
Yeah, that'd be amazing, except for, well, now we have to dig it out.
Now you have to get it back. It's still in New Zealand, I believe, so I'd really like to see it before it goes back to the US, where it's apparently going to remain. It was in a million pieces, too. They had to rebuild the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the primary groups towards the end of the Oligocene are these three groups called the Coronodonids from South Carolina. There's an excellent paleocetologist called Bobby Bosnegger who's written tomes on this group, as well as co-authors. And there's the Atiocetids. They're only found in the North Pacific. We find them in Hokkaido in northern Japan, Mexico, and most of them are found from the Pacific Northwest. So Washington State and Oregon, I think. But we also find the Mammalodontids here in Victoria. And these are another group.
Are they also found in New Zealand?
They are.
Anywhere else or no?
There's a paper from, I think, 2011 where they suggested they might have the lower jaw of a Mammalodontid from Malta. But they based that on, it looks a bit like this is basically the thesis of it.
Right.
So you need a bit more proof than that, I think.
Yeah. What are the best bones to sort of find in whales to ID different groups?
With every whale, the holy grail is the ear bones. So whales, when they had to learn to live underwater, one of the first things they would
Secondarily aquatic animals.
They're just very derived fish.
These weird hoofed animals, they're just weird fish.
But one of the key adaptations to living in water, you see it in seals with the work of Dr. James Rowe. He did some incredible work on the evolution of pinnipeds and seals and the evolution of hearing underwater. Whales had to do a similar thing. They had to completely re-engineer their hearing apparatus to hear underwater. If you look at a modern dolphin, you'll still see these little pinpricks, which are actually the remnant of their external ear canal, which is closed. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So it's not just a matter of you go for a swim, you get water in your ear, it's very annoying. It's dealing with the changes in pressure.
It's completely modifying the ear bones so they work in a different way.
Oh, so they can actually hear their prey.
They need directional hearing, especially things like odontocetes, which are these echolocating whales. Because that's one of the key differences between toothed whales and baleen whales is that toothed whales, like sperm whales and dolphins, have what's called a melon on their skull. Yep. If you ever look at their skulls, they look kind of just like they're shaped like a bowl almost, especially a sperm whale. And they've just got these huge echolocating structures where they can use a structure called the phonic lips to focus sound, and then it'll bounce back off of their target, and then they're able to interpret those sounds to make a three-dimensional map of their surroundings.
Triangulate and work out where they need to go.
That's another major difference between the baleen whales and the toothed whales is that...
melonless.
They're melonless, but they've also gone into infrasound. They communicate through really low-frequency sounds, which travel very far through water, whereas high-frequency sounds that dolphins and sperm whales use, great for detecting your prey close by, and for building that three-dimensional map, but that's not how baleen whales work because they're not going after anything like the same sort of prey.
Deep tones. Think Finding Nemo, Dory.
Yes. Hello. Yes, yes.
We need.
Yes, perfect whale she spoke there. But they did get the baleen plates wrong, but we aren't going to get into that. And their tongues.
So what are their tongues like?
No, this was one of my most horrifying facts I learned about baleen whales when I first started studying them.
Okay. So if you're a bit squeamish, I don't know what he's about to say, so just maybe skip forward a little bit.
So baleen whales, as you'll know, if you've ever seen a video of especially a baleenopterid, which are these, they're called the rorquals. So these are blue whales, humpback whales, minke whales. They have these expandable throat pouches. They can increase their body weight by a factor of 4 when they're eating. And they're already huge animals, right? So when they lunge feed, first thing first, their jaws, their lower mandibles are just floating in their lower jaws. They're not attached bonally to anything.
They're just going to hold you back.
Yeah. So the front of their mandibles disarticulates. The back of their mandibles disarticulates. Their jaws will rotate outwards as well.
They're transformers.
Pretty much. They can open their mouths as much as 90 degrees to the upper jaw. It's a huge gape. And when they'll do that, they'll be able to pull in a huge amount of fish and krill or whatever as they're eating. But where do they put all that water when they're sifting it through their baleen plates when they get it out? So their tongue is actually not a big muscular tongue like you and I have.
Right.
It is actually really floppy. And there's a pouch that expands their mouth cavity called the cavum ventrale. And it goes to where our belly button is, basically. Mm-hmm. The equivalent of where our belly button is. Then they can force their tongue through the bottom of this pouch.
Oh, that's disgusting.
And then they'll fill that whole underside of their body up with water. And then it's thought that there's an elastic nature to the throat pleats, which forces water back out. It's not an entirely muscular effort. And their tongues may also play a role in just forcing that water through their baleen plates to sift the food from it.
So I'm happy you're not knowing that.
They have a big old belly button pouch. If you ever look at it, you see how far back that pouch goes. It's huge if you ever look at videos of a whale lunge feeding. But that is also not the only way a baleen whale can feed.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the alternative?
So gray whales also use baleen in an interesting way. They do what we think a lot of these early whales were doing, which is suction feeding, which is when you generate negative pressure in your mouth to draw food in an aquatic medium into your mouth.
Yeah. This took me a while to work out what suction feeding meant because I was imagining things like going up to something and being like, but like, it's not even that. It's just, isn't it? Going near something and then by opening their mouth really quickly, water will rush to it to fill all that space. And that's how you're getting sort of the suction, is my understanding.
It's partly that because obviously you've got an area where you've got air rather than water.
Yes.
And as soon as you open that, you create a space of negative pressure, I think, which the water is going to rush into. However, you can expand that effect if you have an extremely muscular tongue, which can increase the negative pressure in your mouth, which means you're going to have more of a suction effect of everything brought into your mouth. And there's a really muscular tongue in a gray whale, which they use to, if you ever see them feed, they feed benthically. They feed on the ocean floor. So they'll turn on their sides. And they actually, like us, they're left or right-handed. So some of them feed with mostly their left, some of them feed with mostly their right
That's
side
very
of their
cool.
head. It's a really good way of using baleen because baleen, being keratinous, is always regrowing. So when they wear it down by pulling all this silt and stuff into it, they're able to grow more baleen. But yeah, they pull stuff off of the ocean floor through the side of their mouths. And then they sift it out that way using their muscular tongue. There's a really extreme example of this in a different unrelated group of whales, the sperm whales. They have a tongue that looks more like a piston. It's wild. If you ever look at
like a cylinder.
Yeah. If you ever look at a sperm whale, you'll know it's got these huge teeth all along its lower jaw and no teeth in the upper jaw.
Yeah.
And you would assume that's for catching prey, right? They're not. They don't seem to use their teeth for catching prey at all. They may use them for intraspecific competition where they're fighting amongst each other.
But both males and females have teeth.
Yes, they do. Yes, okay. They do. And they live in these big family groups. There's a huge amount of social hierarchy and understanding. And sperm whales are incredible. But when they're feeding on their primary prey, which is squid at the ocean depths, it's been suggested maybe they've got like some bioluminescence to their teeth, which is used as a lure.
What?
Yeah.
Wild.
But the way they feed is the tongue in their mouth. It's not actually in their mouth. It's in their oropharynx. It's technically in like their throat. And they will pull their tongue back and they create this huge area of negative pressure and they pull the squid into it. And when they were whaling on sperm whales and the age of whaling, they sometimes would cut open the belly of a sperm whale and there'd be a living squid in there.
That's actually horrifying.
Ooh. We interrupt this graphic and unorthodox description of how modern whales feed with a lunch break. As you might have heard, someone came into the room towards the tail end of that discussion, and Ruri and I decided that would be the perfect time to stop, regroup, and collect our thoughts before bringing you more on fossil whales. Without further ado, let's get back to it, and I hope you enjoy.
Okay, we've just come back from lunch. I have to try and stay awake now after having a delicious meatball wrap that both you and Jake recommended. If I start snoring, can you just like keep talking
I'll shake you on the shoulders. It's fine. Yeah, okay, or actually, great. It could just be that thing of just, I'll just keep talking about whales until the battery in the laptop runs out as well. That can
I mean,
too.
It's plugged in, so that's unlikely to happen. Otherwise, just break a glass table. That'll get my attention. Okay. So we've been recording for a long time. Maybe we should actually talk about a specific whale.
Yes.
You were kind of giving us like a broad strokes rundown of different whales.
Different whales feeding apparatuses. Yes. The balaenes.
Balaenes. Yes. And we talked about suction feeding. We talked about
lunge filter feeding.
Yes, I was going to say something else. I thought it started with an S. Glad you hopped in.
The last one, what you find in balaenes, like right whales, is skim filter feeding, where they just have these huge baleen plates. They force their face through the water, and then anything that's in their way, I'm going to hold my fist here. And if you happen to get hit by it, that's your fault.
But thank you for doing the Simpsons quote for me too.
I have to.
You're great.
But that's effectively how modern baleen whales feed. But
okay, that makes me feel less dumb because I just assumed that all whales kind of fed that way unless they were bitey boys.
The bitey boys are different again. So like some of them have long snouts for snapping at fish. Like river dolphins are very different to oceanic dolphins. And they're also not related. They're a much more ancient group. But that's a whole other story. But our specimens that we have here in Victoria are relevant to this because they seem to be this group of whales that has diversified and is not part of this early baleen whale lineage and is doing something entirely different, but possibly is really, really heavily leaning into this suction feeding adaptation as being shown by other members of the Avomorph lab, particularly David Hawking and so on, where they use leopard seals as an example of suction feeding in living animals. Because if you ever look at Jangocetus, the specimen we're talking about here, it's got this crazy short skull. Mm. There was a study that came out last year where they put all these different whales and marine reptiles into what's called a morphospace.
Yeah.
And they found
it's like a graph, and then you're trying to see where things cluster together, and there's kind of shapes drawn around them.
And you can broadly, on each axis, you'd have like a different variable. So in this case, it was bigger teeth, bigger muscles was on one axis, and narrower jaws was on one axis, and broader jaws was on the other. And everything kind of clusters together, sort of longish jaws and a varying degree of like tooth robusticity and muscle attachments and tooth size. Everything's kind of off to the left side here. But if you go over way to the right, you've got these stupidly blunt-jawed Jangocetus, which just does not play by anyone else's rules. And that's
Australia.
The tooth mesticete fauna, as well as being quite diverse, doesn't seem to have had much in the way of an overlap. And it's very much true here in Australia, with the exception of that Malta specimen, which I don't think is a mammalodontid. So it seems like these mammalodontids here are doing something different to every other tooth baleen whale in the fossil record. But the problem is we have so little of them because we only find them right at the end of the Oligocene.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing else here.
Yeah. So Jangocetus, is it just Jangocetus hunderi?
It is.
Yep. For now.
Watch this space. But there's the other mammalodontid specimens are, there's one from New Zealand, which is slightly older than our Victorian ones, called Mammalodon hackatermia. But it kind of exemplifies the problem we have with all of our specimens in Australia and New Zealand. It's the top of the skull, some very worn teeth, and the bottom and one of the ear bones. That's the entire specimen.
Yeah, the teeth were nubs.
Yes.
Also, if anyone was at Kevips, they'll remember this one because you
I made the first ever paleo art of it. Yes.
Yeah.
It's
a whale silhouette on long legs pretending to be a kiwi.
I'm not going to say it's scientifically rigorous. However,
it got a lot of laughs.
It got some
very
laughs.
Memorable.
There you go. It's apparently now Jake's favorite whale because he likes the name Hackatermia, which is fair because
it's
objectively cool. Yeah. But that's the only like name taxon they have in New Zealand. And it's thought that that's because New Zealand in the late Oligocene is this very, it's basically not there.
Yeah, it's a lot of it's underwater.
Most of it's effectively just going to be some island peaks poking out of, at the time, much higher sea levels.
Yeah.
Because the thing that the tooth mesticetes all seem to have liked were these shallow ocean continental shelves, which you had all throughout the world because there was a lot less sea ice. The establishment of the circumpolar Antarctic current, which today is this continuous oceanic
vortex of cold,
nutrient-rich water that circles Antarctica.
Yeah, and it stops warm water from the equator. I think getting down to Antarctica, it's kind of why Antarctica is now frozen in ice, because you're not getting...
It's partly location and partly global climate, but that's why Antarctica is so much colder than the Arctic as well in particular.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. The coldest temperatures on Earth are in the center of Antarctica. It's a regular, like, average temperature. I think it's McMurdo Station's, like, negative 50 degrees or something like that.
Hey, it's Adele with my first ever temperature conversion. So I'm just going to assume here that Ruri was talking about minus 50 Celsius, and that is equal to minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit. So bloody cold.
And do you want to go there?
The fossils aren't there. There's kilometers of glaciers where the rocks there. But the fossils are all in the fringes of Vega and James Ross Island.
Yeah.
That's where I want to go. No, there's going to be more whales there and more dinosaurs.
Yeah. More pterosaurs too.
More pterosaurs.
That would be very cool.
But yes, as a result, sea levels globally, much higher, much bigger oceanic environments on the continental shelves. I think if we stay in Victoria here, the sea level got like where Ballarat is today would be basically at the waterfront.
My goodness.
Yeah.
That's terrifying because Ballarat is nowhere near the coast.
I don't know if it would be on the coast, but at that sort of altitude.
Yeah,
there's a huge continental shelf environment. And with the establishment of the circumpolar current, which is kind of where we'd see the Miocene, the next geologic stage after the Oligocene, we have the beginning of the Miocene glaciations and sea levels globally just drop. And all of these toothed baleen whales just seem to disappear because they were all adapted to live in these shallow ocean environments. So that's why we think they're so rare in New Zealand in comparison, because New Zealand is mostly deep water environments. And most of the baleen whales we find there are these early baleen whales, Eomestacetids, and early Chaomestacetids, the group that includes our modern baleen whales. But here in Victoria, yeah, very shallow ocean environments. And we have at least two different types of Mylodontid seem to do quite different things.
And your fossils come from the Janjak Marl, hence the name Janjacetus.
Very creative, I grant you. Yes. So there's the Janjak formation is composed of the Point Addis limestone and the Janjak Marl. The rocks that produced Mammalodon cleveri and Janjacetus hunderi are both in the Janjak Marl. It's these rocks, a bit like the Victorian Cretaceous, that are eroding out of the shore platform and we're constantly seeing new stuff exposed. But for the most part, everything...
Is it as deadly as the Cretaceous stuff? As in you have to like not stand underneath cliffs fear of getting crushed? Yeah,
yes,
excellent.
Yes. And
great.
Sometimes you can almost drown your friends. Like the last time I went there, I took my friends, Adam, Reed, Tegan, and Liana down there, and they were helping me look for fossils, but I did not read the tides right. So we had to dodge between the tides to get to the exit at Fisherman's Steps. So we're finding a gap in between the tides. It can be perilous, but it's fun. Yeah, a 0.6 tide is not low enough.
And 0.6 meters is equal to 2 feet. We'll also mention 20 centimeters, and that's equal to 2/3 of a foot. Okay, back to it.
That was the day I learned.
Well, if I'm this tall, a 0.6 tide should be fine.
Well, it's usually you go for a 0.4, and it's like, it was 20 centimeters. 20 centimeters is a lot.
If it's flooded, forget it.
Yes, pretty much, yes. You have the right idea around water, I do not. So yeah, most of the stuff we're finding, we're very lucky. This two named specimens from Australia, Mammalodon and Janjacetus, are known from nigh-on complete skulls, especially Janjacetus. It's an amazing specimen. It is one of the most complete, well-preserved fossil baleen whales you'll ever find.
Yeah, it would have made a good state fossil emblem for Victoria.
It would have, alas. And I'm ashamed to say this as a whaleontologist.
Oh, that's right. Who did you vote for?
I voted for the winner, Coelacanthus.
Oh.
You got it.
I was wondering where you'd go because you work on whales.
There was also the Allosaurus.
Yeah.
But like the quintessentially Victorian fossil, it's Coelacanthus.
The weird one.
The
weirdest one.
The weirdest one. Yeah. We love it. But that's fine. Like Janjacetus was my second pick. Like we couldn't
number the ballot paper. It was just a tick and
in. But that's fine. We love it in other ways. But it's very weird. If you saw it bob out of the ocean today, you would not look at that and go, oh, that's a baleen whale.
No, absolutely not.
No.
Because there's a model of it on display at Melbourne Museum
now
as well. I got some like nice photos of it from a few different angles the other day, but I was still just like, I don't know what it is about its face. It's just giving me puppy vibes. It's probably the short nose. I don't know. Or the way the eyes are.
It's interesting you see puppy. A carnivore is probably where you would go. Something maybe a bit like a leopard seal.
Yeah. I think that's what I was subconsciously picking up.
When I've drawn it, I've kind of used that as the inspiration for the coloration I give it. I'll do the spotting a bit like a leopard seal. Mm. Unlike modern toothed whales or early toothed whales, they haven't learned to echolocate, but they have these huge eye sockets. They're about 3 to 4 meters long in body length.
Hey, it's Adele. Just wanted to say that 3 to 4 meters, that's about roughly 10 to 13 feet. Okay, let's get back to Ruri.
And they have these very short snouts. It seems...
Sorry, 3 to 4 meters in body... That's the body length, not the eyes.
Yes, yes. That would... That'd be quite something.
Oh, yeah.
3 to 4 meters entirely. Eye sockets probably about, I don't know, would you say that?
Fist-sized? I don't know.
Fist-sized, but the size of an orange or something. Yeah. You could fit an orange in there. They're huge.
That's a lot of eyeball.
Or maybe a mandarin. A big fruit. A medium-sized
Some
fruit.
Some sort of citrus.
Some sort of citrus will fit in that eye socket. And yet, so it seems like they're using their vision to hunt anything in their immediate vicinity, basically. And unlike Maladon, they've got these big, sharp teeth, seem to have these relatively strong jaws. It's probably... feeding on small prey, much smaller than it though, and using suction feeding that's generating negative pressure to draw prey into it. Yeah, exactly. Like a modern leopard seal or like a modern dolphin. There's a very controversial topic in whale paleontology regarding toothed filter feeding, which is again something we probably don't have time to get into. But leopard seals do something called tooth filter feeding, which if you saw James Rolls talk at KVEBS, you'll have known he's talking about the
crab-eater seals that do not eat crabs. They eat krill with these bizarre teeth.
With these big nodules on them, and they get these big little gaps between them. When they close their mouths, they'll push water through their teeth and the prey is retained inside because of these gaps. Yeah. Yeah. We don't see anything like that in toothed mesocetes, to the best of our ability. It was suggested for an animal, Coronodon, but that has yet to be definitively proven, and I don't necessarily think that's necessarily the case. But that's a whole other matter again. So yes, it's likely that it's probably feeding in the water column, and I would say probably on small fish and things of that nature.
And
it would probably
Are its teeth like pointy cones, or
the teeth?
Like...
This is the thing. It's spectacular about Maladontids. They have the most beautiful teeth of any animal you will probably ever see in your entire life. They are immaculate. They're spectacular. They're either triangular or circular in cross section. As they get further towards the back of their mouth, they have these striations all down one side and all down the other side. Up and down lines, but they're also intersecting. They're hugely complex patterns all over them. They have cusps all along the edges and the back and front of the teeth. They've got extra points all along them. And some specimens, we even find extra cutting surfaces on the inside of the teeth. They're so pointy and so intricate.
That's wildly unnecessary.
Well,
sorry, as soon as you said cutting surfaces on the inside, I just became super aware of my tongue on my teeth, and I'm like, ugh.
Well, it's like that thing whenever someone mentions your heartbeat and you start noticing it.
Or you're breathing as well.
Well, I don't think you have internal cusps pointing inwards, but I'm not your dentist. I wouldn't want to presume. But yeah, they're wildly complex teeth, and it's possible.
And they're very diagnostic. So if you found one in the fossil record, you'd be like, this is definitely... So,
again, with the thing of endemism, the localization of...
Endemism, or if something's endemic to an area, it's from that area and it's only found in that area.
Yes. And that seems to be a case again for a lot of tooth mesocetes. We only find Coronodon in South Carolina. We only find Adiacetes in the North Pacific, and we only find Mammalodons in New Zealand and Australia.
Yeah. Call back to that preference for shallow shelf environments.
Yes.
Even though they're living in the ocean, they're not going to go across the ocean, the deep ocean environments, to intermix with different populations or anything like that, because that's what they're cut out to do. They want to be on the continental shelf. So I guess it's like I'm anthropomorphizing them heavily here with this, but it's almost like they want to touch the bottom. They don't want to go out into the deep.
Exactly. Yeah. They're be monsters. We don't go out there. They're living at the same time as Otodus angustidans as well. Otodus angustidans, you may be familiar with the genus name Otodus, because they know another animal that belongs to that genus, Megalodon. Otodus angustidans is probably a forerunner of Megalodon. Didn't get to quite the same size, but I think it's like a 7 or 8 meter long shark.
that's still too big.
Or bigger. We have some teeth in the collection here and they're colossal.
Pew! Hey, it's Adele. I had a quick look online and there are some bigger numbers being thrown around, but let's just stick with 7 to 8 meters. That's equal to 23 to 26 feet long. So whichever way you look at it, it's still honking massive and not something you want to mess with.
And they are
don't go in the water.
Don't go in the water. But they're also probably feeding out in the deep ocean as well as they're probably visitors to the Jangjug Marl. They're not so much permanent residents there.
Right. So there'll be temporary terror.
Yeah. This is the other thing that's interesting about Jangjuk. As well as these bizarre tooth mesocetes, we find these bizarre odontocetes, a group called the Waipatiids, which are found also in New Zealand. We find the forerunners of the baleen whales. We find a group called Eomestocetes, which are this group of sort of baleen whales that had sometimes had teeth at the front of their jaws. We find other groups, which I can't talk about yet, but we do not expect to find here, and we no longer find here anymore. It's a wildly unusual fauna that you find here in Jangjuk at the same period.
Yeah. So we've talked about form. Hopefully everyone can sort of picture what it is.
Just, yeah, big eyes, big teeth. Could probably bite your hand off, but it would have looked really cute with these big eyes and its little short snout, I think. Yeah. It would have been adorable.
And then touched on what it was eating, probably fish, squid, suction feeding,
yep. Definitely.
Not the biggest thing in its environment.
Oh,
either.
Definitely not, no. But it was also living alongside Mammalodon as well, which is this other tooth mesocete from here in Victoria. And if you ever look at its teeth, they're worn down to nubs in the holotype.
Yeah, and we've sort of talked about the function, like what it was doing in its environment mm-hmm. and that sort of thing as well. How's the taxonomy? Because this question is always hell. Yeah, that's the exact taxonomy. Oh, this is always death.
It's worse for mammalodontids
as well.
So as I said, these are near the base of the baleen whale radiation, the first ever baleen whales. They're not the first offshoot of that branch that leads to modern baleen whales. The first are these Yanacetas in Antarctica and South America, but they're really close to the base in a lot of analyses. And that's what's so interesting about them only being found in the late Oligocene of New Zealand and Australia.
So does that mean maybe like this is an origin point for that group or?
Well, possibly, but if you don't have any early Oligocene rocks to base it, like we don't know.
We could come to that conclusion, but you could also just be like, well, I don't have data to tell me to the contrary. So yeah.
We don't see them anywhere else. It would seem likely that they're probably evolved here in Australia and evolved to whatever the conditions were in Australia and got really good at, because it's the other thing is also there's only 2 species here for the entire place, whereas there's like 21 species of Atiacetas in the North Pacific.
Oh.
Yeah. They're relatively. Yeah, they're relatively obscure, yeah. But there was a paper that came out by a PhD student, Josh Corey, last year, where he was talking about Cacanodontids, which is this group of late surviving archaeocetes. So if you remember Basilosaurus from earlier in the conversation, they seem to be the last of these surviving archaeocetes, things like Basilosaurus, these big predatory whales, and they seem to be filling that apex. As well as Atodus angustidens, there were also Cacanodontids, big predatory whales that were also living at this time period. And in his paper on New Zealand Cacanodontids, he did a phylogenetic analysis and he found Mammalodontids to be not mesocetes, not baleen whales.
Uh-oh.
He found them to be stem neocetes, which is the group that includes all tooth whales and baleen whales. So this kind of like,
so like further back in the tree.
Before the ancestor of all modern whales is where they found them to be. But they've also been found in other analyses as the sister to, so the closest relatives of Atiacetids, which are almost always found to be the last diverging group of tooth mesocetes before you get to the group that includes the ancestors of all modern baleen whales. So they've been found very far up the tooth mesocete tree and they've been found very far down at almost an outside of baleen whales. It's very
hard to say.
I'm
so sorry.
But this gets to what a bit my PhD is on as well.
Well, I guess that's why it's important, because hopefully new fossils will help kind of constrain and pull the group and give us a little bit more certainty about where are they actually if they've been everywhere.
Well, it's also the fact of the better we can understand their anatomy, the more we can say about what is unique to mammalodontids.
This is a juvenile trait. This is a generic trait.
When most of the fossils you're finding in Jangjuk are isolated teeth, isolated ear bones, which you can basically say mammalodontid, or you can say it's not mammalodon, it's probably Jangucetus, or it's not Jangucetus, it's probably mammalodon. That doesn't give you a lot of room to like describe characters, so structures on these fossil bones that are unique to that group, because you've only got those 2 very complete skulls to work with. So any new mammalodontid material we have is going to make it a lot easier for us to describe them and potentially to better understand their family groupings. But to sum up, It's a car crash.
Dumpster fire. Get it out of here.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll ask a fun question because taxonomy is always death. What would be a great fossil to find from the Jandak Mall? That would just really help your PhD.
Can I give a different answer?
Of course.
I happen to know in the collection we have specimens, ones I haven't got time to study for my PhD, which are going to help a lot in the stuff I'm talking about right now in terms of clarifying those maladontid relationships and the anatomy that refers to them. But they're ultimately still going to be constrained to this late Oligocene rock layer, which means we're only ever going to know what was happening towards the end of a maladontid evolution. What would be really good is something from the early Oligocene, the earliest Oligocene that we can ascribe to maybe like a very early mammalodontid that tells us what their early relationships are like and how they fed it. Because we know with Adiacetids, we can track them from the beginning of the Oligocene all the way to the end. We have stuff that goes almost to the Eocene and stuff that just appeared before. It covers 10 million years. You get so many different specimens and they tell us a lot about their diversity and how wacky and weird they got and all the different tooth counts they had and all the different snout shapes they had and all the different ways they were seeming to evolve in their environment. And mammalodontids, we know what they were doing in the late Oligocene here in Victoria and in New Zealand. That's it. If we could go and find a early Oligocene site that preserved evidence of any cetaceans in Australia beyond Willungacetus, which is a very undiagnostic skull that was found in the 1990s in South Australia. Like, we can't diagnose it to a family group based on what we have, unfortunately.
Why not? If it's a skull.
It's all the bits of the skull you don't want. Oh. It's like, you get no ear bones, you get no teeth, you've got the top
you can't scan the jaws to see if there's like unerupted teeth. It's just gone.
There's no jaws.
Oh, wait. They don't replace their teeth either.
They do not replace their teeth.
Sorry, no. That was a reptile.
No, that's
my reptile, reptile paleo, reptile brain saying, yeah, just look for the extra teeth. That
no, this is why you end up with such beautiful teeth. You only get one. You got to do maybe two. We don't actually, this is the other thing.
Or you get nubs.
Well, we don't even know if they had milk teeth because.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Basilosaurs. Wow. Okay. We know basilosaurs had milk teeth. We know they had an early set of teeth that they then replace with their adult teeth.
Right.
But we know that modern dolphins don't do that. They have one set of teeth.
So when did they switch?
Yeah.
Or how many times have they switched?
Like, but they aren't dolphins as well. We know baleen whales don't have them at all. We know that if you get an embryo of a baleen whale, you can see the tooth buds are starting to form and then they get switched off later on in development. So we know that they definitely had teeth when they were born, but we don't actually know.
Yeah, the programming's there, but it's just whether the light switch is turned on or off.
Yeah, but we don't even know if they had one or two sets of teeth. So yeah. Anything that tells us more about the early evolution of this group would be incredible. And all it would take would be a single ear bone or a single tooth from that time period.
Yeah, one fossil can completely change our understanding. Yeah.
That's what I'm hoping it finds.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're going to head off to...
I get 4 days in Adelaide at the end of the month. I'm hoping to find something. We've got some early Oligocene outcrops where Willungacetus was found, so we'll see what we can see.
Sounds absolutely awesome. We've mentioned before Jandakotsubis was nominee for State Fossil Emblem.
Yep.
Is there any like other pop culture references you can think of?
Maladontids.
Yeah.
I don't think toothmist seats are even known by the vast majority.
Probably not. Ew. Hey, it's Adele and I have Ruri with me as well. We remembered something that we probably should have mentioned in our episode.
Namely, this is Pals and Paleo, which is the Yowie fan podcast. And I'm aware that I should be banned from the podcast forever for not remembering that Mammalodon, the specimen which I did mention at some point in here, does have a Yowie. I don't have it though. However, we do have Basilosaurus aplenty. Got the PNSO one right here. It's so long.
It's too long.
It's too long. Yeah, no, they don't put enough meat on the head as well. It's very skinny looking. It looks quite emaciated, I think. But it gets across just how crazy the anatomy of these guys was.
Long.
But it was part of how they paddled. They could paddle side to side as well as up and down. It's thought to be the reason they may have gone as long as they did, as I understand it, is that they would have used the extended length for more
swishing.
Yeah. Their vertebrae are quite good for doing that sort of motion. Side to sidey, like a fish, rather than up and downy,
like a dolphin
or any other whale. All whales go uppy downy. And that is my addendum. Mammalodon Yowie. I'm so sorry, everyone.
And that's it?
That's it.
Okay, so we've now cleared that up. There is, in fact, a Mammalodon Yowie. Let's throw back to Ruri and hear about other representations of fossil whales in pop culture.
Honestly, the main representation I've seen for cetaceans, fossil cetaceans, in paleo media has been mostly a little later or a little earlier in their evolution. So there's a lot of documentaries. Walking with Beasts did Ambulocetus.
Oh, yeah. That's like a... sort of Walking with Dinosaurs.
Sequel. What was it? Beast or
I was going to say spinoff. I think it came after.
I don't know if it came after.
I don't know.
I don't know, man.
I haven't watched it. You know that.
David Adele, an accessory to Walking with Dinosaurs.
Adjacent.
Well, I watched Walking with Dinosaurs religiously as a kid. I only watched whatever the other two were. Because there was one that was set before Walking with Dinosaurs, one that was set after. And the Cenozoic ones and the Paleozoic. But yeah, whatever the Cenozoic BBC documentary was had an Ambulocetus. Though they put it in Poland, I think. And they made it live in like a lake. Which is wrong.
Okay.
Because it lives in what is today the Himalayas and like these near shore, these riverine environments, which it then dispersed out to North Africa and places like that near the Tethys Sea or the Paratethys Sea.
That's super choice to get Poland and the Himalayas mixed up.
I don't know if it was Poland, but it was definitely not living where it should have been living.
Right.
But it's doing broadly the right sort of thing. It's a mammalian crocodile, basically.
Okay.
But then when you go beyond that, basilosaurs feature quite prominently. I think they're in Nigel Marvin's Prehistoric Park. He has basilosaurs in that one.
I have no idea.
You don't see Prehistoric Park?
No.
Oh, Adele.
I haven't seen so many things.
Adele. All right. I know basilosaurs features a lot in like paleo media and paleo games and things, but that's about it.
Oh, like Ark or something.
I'm pretty sure basilosaurs features an Ark. I've never played Ark. I don't like the survival mechanics at all.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't
want to have to feed myself. I'm already doing that.
I don't want to be stressed. I'm already stressed.
Exactly.
Let me do something fun.
Just let me, yeah. I think beyond that, like the other fossil cetacean that obviously gets a lot of attention is one they have a picture of behind us here. Leviathan, things like the killer sperm whale, but they're Miocene. They're long after the extinction of the toothed Mysticetes.
They're what, 5 million years?
Yep. 5 to 10 million years later. They were found all over the southern part of the globe. We find them here in Australia. We find them in a site called Beaumaris and in South America. They seem to have been feeding on the descendants of things like Mammalodon, these small baleen whales that lived here at the time. They had these big artillery shell sized teeth.
I look at them and I think they're sweet potatoes.
They look like sweet potatoes. They're huge.
See, Ben?
But yeah, I'm sorry to say, but tooth mesocetes are chronically underrepresented. But that means that whenever I draw them, there tends to not be a lot of art to take my spot whenever I do it. So that's nice.
Yeah. So if people want to stay up to date with you and your work and also see your paleo art, where can they find you?
I am on Instagram mostly with my name, which you'll have to spell out, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. R-U-A-I-R-I-D-H Duncan, D-U-N-C-A-N.
It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing.
Just to circle back to the start of this conversation, this three-part conversation, I think we're trying to like relocate the trackways and stuff, but we're also trying to work out how to say and spell your name. David Elliott just gave up. He was like, I'm just going to call you Roo.
Yep.
And it's like...
Which is honestly better than most. Most people just go with Rory, which is worse because that's a complete... Roo is at least the first syllable he's got.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, kudos to you, David Elliott. Well done. I'm also on other things as Inxcetus, Inxcetus. If you ever see me on GT7, you'll probably beat me because I'm really slow now. But I have whales on the side of my car, so you'll be able to spot me easily.
Excellent. Thank you so much for spending time to chat about whaleontology and could keep chatting about your paleo art process, but I have taken up a huge chunk of your time today.
I've had an amazing time. Thank you, Adele.
No worries.
Yeah, loving the podcast as well. You're doing terrific work. It's fantastic.
What an absolute legend. I really hope you enjoyed this lengthy interview and discussion about Rory's journey into paleontology, as well as facts on whales and a little bit on ornithopod dinosaurs. Since I know Rory personally, we spoke before we recorded and I knew he was happy to talk about some of the marks that he's gotten in the past. And I really wanted to highlight this because you can have less than stellar grades and you can still do a PhD if that's what you want to do. But as I want to delve into in future episodes, it's not just academia. There's other skills that we need within the field in order to make these groundbreaking discoveries. Okay, I'll jump off my soapbox now. That's enough about that. If you want to see some of Rory's paleo art, you can go onto his Instagram, as we mentioned before, but we also mentioned the Prehistoric Bayside exhibition that's coming up that Ben Franciselli from our episode on Pelagornis is putting together. Rory has been working like a madman on these amazing, massive, detailed pieces of art and collaborating with friend of the show, Zev Lenz, who you'll be hearing from later this year. And I cannot wait to see everything pulled together. But I just wanted to highlight that too, because I have so much respect for Rory. He's doing amazing work academically and has talent beyond measure. So again, super appreciative for him being on the show. Pals and Paleo would not be possible without our amazing editor, Francie. Francie came up with the theme music alongside some of his bandmates, Hello Kelly, who are currently on hiatus. You can still find their music on Spotify and their album Sweet Nostalgia, which is super choice, still in my top 10 favorite albums. Plus, you can also find Francie's solo project, Francie Planet, on there too, or wherever else you get music. Massive thanks to Crumpet Club for creating our podcast cover art, particularly Jenny Zhao of Jenny Z Design on Instagram for creating this really fun, vibrant, approachable, accessible cover art. It just perfectly brought together some of the core values for the show. And thank you to Steve Porapat for providing some feedback on our last episode with Jack O'Connor so that I could fact check it and bring you some corrections. And final thank you is for you. Thank you so much for listening and investing this time with me. I know your time is precious. You could probably be watching things on TikTok or listening to other podcasts, but the fact that you've decided to listen and learn about ancient animals from weird parts of the world, particularly Australia, just means the absolute well to me. Thank you so much. Pals and Paleo will be back soon, and our next episode is going to be with Kane Fleury. We're going to be talking about some ichnological structures. We're going to be talking about fossil footprints from one of New Zealand's most iconic fossils, the moa. So I can't wait for you to listen to that. But until next time, just keep digging, just keep swimming, and I'll speak to you soon.